Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. In 2000, caught in the throes of serious mental illness, Kevin Hines hurled himself off the Golden Gate Bridge and lived to tell about it. He's one of 36 jumpers to survive the fall. More than 2,000 people have made that jump since the bridge was built in 1937. Hines has since dedicated his life to suicide prevention and fighting the stigma of mental illness. He made the commitment to share his story after a visiting priest at the Catholic hospital where he was treated told him he was called to share his testimony as a way of helping himself and others. Kevin Hines, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You have become one of the most effective advocates for suicide prevention in the country because of your own story of survival. Tell us about September 25th, 2000. You were 19 years old.
I was 19, and I was battling bipolar disorder inadequately. I was living with a brain disease that both my biological parents had before me. I'm adopted. And I wasn't fighting it well. I was not following a treatment program that my doctors thought I was. I was living with my dad at the time, parents divorced. I became so depressed after a manic episode, skyrocketing into euphoric natural highs, and I crashed into a depression that was so dark and dismal. Voices in my head, and that means auditory hallucinations, told me I had to die, told me I had no other course to take, and that that was going to be the end of me, and I was going to go to the Golden Gate Bridge, and I had to jump off. And I didn't realize at the time that that was a distorted reality, that the voices in my head were lying. I didn't have to die. But it was so overwhelmingly powerful. Your brain is so powerful that when your brain is sick, so goes the rest of you, as they say.
You talk in your speeches about the fact that we spend so much time working on our physical health, everything from the neck down, and so little preserving and enhancing our mental health.
I always say, look at all the organs in your body, right? Isn't your brain the most important one? And yet people all around the world see those with brain diseases, what most call a mental illness. I don't call them that. I don't believe in that term. Mental is a negative connotation of a word, and illnesses are temporary and can be cured. What I have is 24/7, 365. I have to fight it tooth and nail every day. If I don't, I won't be here. And I almost died. I attempted off that bridge, and I almost died.
It's miraculous that you didn't.
1% survived that fall in 80 years, 36 people. Of the over 2,000 that have died there, one of the highest places of suicide in the world. Five of us have regained full physical mobility. They call it the most exclusive survivors club in the world.
Describe, if you will, the impact on the human body of falling the equivalent of 25 stories at 75 miles per hour.
Well, I don't want to get into the details of the method only because the people listening who are in pain might relate to that in a bad way. What I will tell you is that what people don't understand about the Golden Gate Bridge and that attempt is that the thoughts of suicide are often very separate from the act of suicide. So when people think about suicide and they think about it the way they're going to attempt and the method they're going to use, that thought, however long you've been thinking about it or however impulsive it may be, either way, is separate from the act of attempting. People all over the world have reacted to surviving an attempt of all kinds of means, like I reacted, instant regret from their actions.
You say the minute your hands left the rail, because you catapulted yourself off the rail.
The millisecond my hands left that rail, I had an instant regret from my actions. Now, that's important because 19 of the remaining people alive from that fall. There are about 26 of us who still live. The rest have died of natural causes. It's been 80 years since the bridge's opening. 19 have all come forward, the majority of those still alive, to say they had that exact same instant regret from their actions and belief that all they wanted to do was live, but they thought it was too late. Now, that is common with suicide means all over the world. When people have survived attempts, the millisecond they thought they were going to die, they had an instant regret.
You talk about your hands leaving the railing and having that thought, but a number of almost miraculous things happened. You hit the water. you realized you hadn't died, and a motorist going across the bridge saw you. Tell us what happened.
A driver, my understanding is a red car, a woman, as she drove by me on the bridge, she saw me go over, and she called her friend. Her friend was in the United States Coast Guard, manning the very waters of that bridge. It's my understanding the only reason they got to my position within less than the time I'd set in hypothermia was because of that woman. In the water, as I flailed to stay afloat, I kept going down. My legs were not mobile. I could not move them.
Because of severe spinal injuries.
That's right. I broke my back in several places. And in the water, something began to circle beneath me, something very alive and very large. I thought it was a shark. I'm freaking out at this time because I think it's going to bite my leg off or something, or worse. But it never bites. It just circles faster and faster. I'm no longer wading in the water to stay afloat. I'm being kept buoyant by this creature. And I'm really thinking in my head, well, I guess this is a nice shark. And I would learn what this creature was. I went on a television show promoting a suicide prevention campaign for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention on ABC television on a show called Primetime Live with that guy, John Quinones, the host who does the show, What Would You Do? And on the show, he asked me a bunch of questions, and I mentioned I thought there was a shark beneath me in the water. Well, people wrote into the show from all over the world. But one man wrote in and said, Kevin, I'm so very glad you're alive. I was standing less than 2 feet when you jumped. To this day, no one would ever tell me if you lived or died until I saw this show. By the way, Kevin, there was no shark in the water, but there was a sea lion. And the people above looking down believed it to be keeping you afloat until the Coast Guard boat arrived behind you. And then he said he had pictures, which is interesting.
I saw those pictures.
My father saw those pictures, and it's crystal clear. In the motion of the pictures, as in picture by picture, you can see the sea lion circling, what seems to be a lifeless body atop the water. The Coast Guard arrived. They fished me out of the water. They saved my life physically. They got me to an ambulance. Ambulance took me to the hospital. But I think one of the most moving experiences I've had in my entire life was when my father, the year to the date of my attempt, the anniversary, September 25th, 2001, I got in his car after City College and he said, we're going for a drive. I'm thinking, oh, we're just going to go get burgers at Beeps. And which, by the way, is the best burger place in San Francisco or used to be. And we start driving, and I realize we're going down Park Presidio. We're going to the Golden Gate Bridge. I said to my dad, Dad, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. He said, Kevin, we have to. We need closure. And I'm thinking, well, you need closure. I need to get out of this car right now. And he pulls over at a flower bed, and he says, pick a flower. And there were a bunch of purple tulips with yellow and gold inside. And I look up at this building that the flowers are next to. It's the Police Officers Union building. And a bunch of police officers are roaming around in the windows. Police cars line up the parking lot. Dad, I can't pick a flower here. San Francisco, you pick a flower, you get arrested. Or you get fined. He says, pick a goddamn flower. Pardon my French. I pick a flower, and we go to the bridge. Now, before I even get out of the car, I have vertigo. I can barely stand. I'm nauseous. I don't want to do this. And my dad reiterates, we need to do this. We need closure. And I think he needed it more than me, in a sense. But we go out, and he says, show me where. And I walked him to the area, and we stood there. We held that flower, and he grabbed my hand. We said in our Father, and I dropped the flower. And I watched this flower kind of waft down slowly. It's very light, you know. Hits the water, makes the tiniest of a ripple effect. And 2 feet to the right, popped up a sea lion. And I will never, ever forget that moment. Neither will my father. And that's why this film I'm making, Suicide, The Ripple Effect, is named what it's named. It's not about the ripple effect of the pain from suicide. It's about the ripple effects of hope that stories have to help people find recovery, hope, and healing. And now there are even some scientific studies today that register the impact of stories like mine that have helped people choose life.
You say the common denominator, no matter where people are in the world, is pain. Pain that loved ones don't seem to recognize just how significant it is.
You know, all too often in our society, like we talked about the relaxed idea of how you take care of your brain. The notion that, you know, it's just not really an organ. You know, the way people look at it, the way people tell people like me to snap out of it, get over it, move on, because they don't understand that brain pain and brain diseases are as real as a physical disease below the neck. And you know, I think about how we don't recognize that if we don't have brain health, we don't have health. We don't recognize the significance of this pain that derives from your head, because we think of pain all too physical. Oh, he's got a broken arm, he's got a cast on his arm, or even liver disease. You can see that on a scan, on a ultrasound. Sure, you get it. It's visible. You can't see what's in my head. So you invalidate my experience. And I mean, people, you can't see what's going on in my head. And the mental pain or brain pain is far worse than any physical pain I have ever experienced. And I am not talking about that as a person who hasn't been there. When I broke my back, I experienced the most physical pain in my entire life, but it was nothing compared to the enemy I battle with in my own head.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia, and our guest is Kevin Hines. At age 19, Kevin attempted to take his own life by jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge. His story chronicles the extraordinary will to live mentally well in the face of his mental illness, bipolar disorder with psychotic features. Today, Hines is a mental health advocate, award-winning global speaker, and best-selling author of Cracked, Not Broken, Surviving and Thriving After a Suicide Attempt. In spite of how far you've come and all that you have accomplished, you still suffer from suicidal ideation. Every day it's something you deal with. What makes you so confident today that despite the voices, you are not going to take your own life?
So, right. So it's not every day, but I have regular suicidal thoughts. They plague me. They're part of what I go through now in my battle with this brain disease. And you know why it's okay? Because I have built a support network of people who see my pain, address my pain, and ask me the blunt question, Kevin, are you in danger of suicide and do you have a plan? And I have become strong enough, self-willed enough, and self-aware enough that every time someone asks me that question, someone who loves me, I'm going to tell them the absolute truth. But even before they ask me that question, usually I'm the one today that walks up to them and says three words, I need help.
Which you couldn't ask on September 25th, 2000. And in fact, you're sitting on the floor in your father's bedroom hoping that he's going to see what's going on in your head, but not having the whatever it takes to say, Dad, I need help.
Yeah, at that moment in my house, you know, my dad at 7 a.m. asked me if I'd be with him that day.
He knew you were in trouble.
Yeah, he asked me over and over again if I'd be with him that day. And now everyone who hears my presentation thinks, well, why didn't you just tell him? You know, my dad did his best with what he knew.
You say your dad would say to you, Kevin, I'm a banker.
Yeah. Kevin, I'm a banker, not a psychologist, you know. And he did the best he could with what he knew, but he wasn't trained in suicide prevention. Nobody in my family was.
Who is?
None of my friends are. Well, we all should be. That's the issue, see? We have all of these people around the world who are in positions of hope for people, but they don't know what to say or what to do or how to reach that
individual.
Or what not to do.
And the reality is that suicide rates are going up around the world. Now, I just want to mention something. In the United States, 60% of suicides are by gun. In Britain, most suicides are committed by hanging. In India and other Asian countries, by taking poison, particularly taking pesticides because it's readily available. So I'm wondering, would making access to gun access or whatever means more difficult, would that change the rate? Or would a suicidal person likely just choose another way to take his or her life?
So one of the only ways statistically we know how to actually prevent suicide is reduction of access to lethal means, meaning those pesticides or those pills or that rope or those knives or those guns.
Well, no, of course, you're not going to get rid of all of these things.
You're not going to get rid of them. We can make them more safe. When you deliver a bottle of pills that anyone can get at the pharmacy, that if that whole bottle of pills is taken can kill someone, at two pills instead of 30 in a bottle, you've just reduced suicide. when you take guns and mandate that they have to be in a gun lock and that that gun lock has to be inaccessible at a time when a thumbprint is pressed on that box that generates a recognition of increased adrenaline, you can stop a person from suicide. Give them that second.
And you were looking for that moment.
I was looking
you
for that moment.
You got on a bus that took you to the Golden Gate Bridge, and you didn't just go straight to the railing and leap over.
Yeah.
You walked up and down for 40 minutes, hoping that someone would say, Kevin, don't do it, or Kevin, can I help, or Kevin, what's wrong?
I had made a pact with myself. If one person on that bus says to me, are you okay, is something wrong, or can I help you, I would have told that person everything and begged them to save me. I couldn't tell my father that morning. I was ambivalent on that bus, and all I wanted was to survive while my brain was trying to kill me. Now, if we reduce access to lethal means, we are going to save people's lives that are in these very positions that I was in. We are going to help people recognize how much they deserve to be here, but it takes time between that thought and that act. And to find that time, you have to globally find a way, and there is a way, it is possible, to reduce access to many lethal means.
Well, let me just say, at Cornell University, there's a very popular place where lots of young people have tragically taken their lives,
yeah.
And that's the Gorge Bridge.
Yeah.
And I think back in 2000, the university erected steel cables, and there's a concerted effort to prevent suicides there.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any effort underway at the Golden Gate Bridge, which, as you said, has already taken the lives of 2,000 people?
Yes. My father founded the Bridge Rail Foundation in 2006 after the film The Bridge came out.
About you?
Well, partially about my story. It was just a 10-minute piece of the film. But it was really about the deaths that occurred at the Golden Gate Bridge for nearly 80 years at that point. And I'm happy to say that by 2020, it has been approved. We found the $76 million to fund the net at the Golden Gate Bridge. And by 2020, there will be no more deaths at that bridge by suicide. It will be impossible. And that's,
but will people just find another way?
No. Jumpers, they choose those heights for a reason. Ease of access to lethal means. And they're not ready to look at any other way of attempting. That's been looked at. But I'll tell you this. A study was done by Dr. Richard Seiden of 500 individuals. In 25 years, he followed people who had survived that fall or been pulled to safety before they jumped. Of those 25 people, 96% never attempted again after they got mental health help.
How many, what percentage of those who have attempted suicide have gotten the help you're talking about? And what difference does the 21st Century Cures Act, which just passed?
Parity. Parity for mental health care as it stands for physical health care. It's exactly what I said in the beginning of this conversation. Brain health, if we don't have it, we don't have health. Yet our society has condemned those who battle this kind of brain pain. They have said that they blame them. In a sense, those who have addictions, substance use disorder, and those who live with brain diseases such as bipolar disorder, schizophrenia. If we can recognize that this is as important, if not more important, than our physical health, and really have these insurance companies who are ignoring the letter of the first parity law by Patrick Kennedy and not giving equal care, when are we going to get it through our thick skulls? This passed. Now we're in motion. Let's do this. Let's equalize physical and brain health. And let's just call it one thing.
Health.
Health. Just health.
And you point out that if a loved one is in the hospital because of heart disease, for example, the cards pour in, the visits pour in, the flowers from the gift shop pour in.
The teddy bears.
What happens when you're in a psychiatric ward and you have actually been there seven times?
Yeah. Seven wards, seven bouts of pain and seven lessons learned. And in those seven wards, of all seven, the numeric majority of individuals, as we call them patients or consumers today, I call them citizens of hope. Those citizens of hope that I've seen, the majority numerically in each ward, have had no one to come see them at all. That's preposterous. The shame, guilt, blame, misunderstandings, judgment. That's why. The fear of the family being judged. I go to the hospital, somebody will see me and they'll know my kid's in there. No. Look, if you have liver disease, I'm going to go see you and I'm going to bring you those flowers and I'm going to be that shoulder to lean and cry on, and I'm going to tell you you're going to beat this. Where is that reaction on a massive scale for the first time one of our loved ones sees the inside of a psych ward?
In fact, you say if you know someone who is suffering and is suicidal, there are five things we need to do. What are they?
You can talk to your loved one with this kind of a disease until you and they are blue in the face. But you can't make them move or change their behavior or actions because of their pain. So stop talking. It's not about what you say. It's about what you do. What I implore people to do, this was comes from Canada, where people in psych wards are given gift baskets. They're care packages of things that that individual already loves. So you're not telling them how much you love them. You're showing them. And one of the things I have worked with people to do all over the world in the last 16 years in my efforts in the field of prevention and brain health and wellness, when you have an individual in your life who you love, who is experiencing this kind of pain, but doesn't recognize their symptoms, signs, triggers, and warning issues before they get in trouble with ups and downs of depression and the mood swings and even psychosis, write these people 3 to 5 letters. The letters come from 3 to 5 individuals in that family or that personal protector network, 3 to 5 individuals that love that person. And they are including 5 things. In this letter that is handwritten, put in an envelope and mailed like the olden days, all right? You know, everyone loves getting mail. You include empathy, a complete lack of judgment, compassion for their pain, unconditional love, and most importantly, in those letters, each one of them from each person, what you see that is hurting the family and what you see that is hurting the individual. What are they acting out on that they don't even recognize because of their pain and their distorted reality? What do you see the signs, symptoms, triggers that are they are experiencing? Explain it in common, plain language so that they see, oh, this person loves me. This person cares about me. This person is not judging me. This person is compassionate for me. I'm doing all these things. I didn't know I was doing those things. I didn't know I was having that effect on you.
Is that what happened in your case? How, after jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge and surviving, did you come to achieve mental health?
I was in my third psych ward stay of 7, the third involuntary psych ward stay.
302.
Against my will. California, they call it 5150. And I hit a wall. I was a mess. I was overweight. I had a beard coming 6 inches off my face and a hair going the same route in the upside. And I was my uncle came to see me, my Uncle George, on my mom's side. And he said, Kevin, your family can help you until we are blue in the face. But until and when you find the ability to accept that you have this disease and you fight it tooth and nail, nothing's going to change. And he dropped a Time magazine article on the table. He had a rolled up Time magazine article. And it was on finding balance and wellness past a brain disease like this through routine. So today, I exercise 26 minutes a day. Because 26 minutes of rigorous exercise a day leads to 12 hours of better mood, or better brain health, better somatic wellness. I eat healthy foods most days because it helps my brain heal and function at the highest capacity. I educate myself as to my brain disease because if I don't, who will? And because I will learn by doing that on a regular basis all of the newest, reputable, formidable forms of treatment for bipolar disorder, and I will survive. Bipolar for Dummies is a great book for people who love someone with bipolar disorder. Loving Someone with Bipolar Disorder by Julie A. Fast is another great book for someone living with bipolar disorder if you want to learn about what they're going through and truly understand that individual without judgment and with compassion and empathy. Bipolar Hope Magazine, bphope.com. They put out Schizophrenia Digest, Bipolar Hope Magazine, and Esperanza Magazine, which happens to mean hope in Spanish. And hope is my biological grandmother's name. It's fitting. So all of these tools help me to survive, and they help the people around me to understand what I'm really going through when most people can't express or explain this kind of pain to someone who doesn't understand.
Explain the denial. And I want to back up a little by saying that you were an athlete in high school. You played football. You were a champion wrestler. Today, you look like a very fit young guy. Why the denial? Why do you think most people deny that they have this mental illness?
We have shamed people with this kind of brain pain for centuries. I don't know if you know this, but in the early days, when you died by suicide, you were placed in a wooden coffin with no name at the fork in the road with a stake through your heart, and they took all your family's worldly possessions, their house, their clothes, on their back, their food, their ways to earn money. It was all taken, and that family became homeless.
Wow.
Yeah, that's right. So if we want to know where this shame and immediate discrimination against ourselves and against those who live with this kind of suffering today came from, it came from centuries ago. It came from the churches of this world saying, if you die by suicide, you're kicked out of the church and so is your family. And when that happened not because people were dying. That happened because donations stopped coming in from that family.
Oh, my.
You bet. Now, the Pope just recently, the last Pope, denounced that theory that, no, suicide and depression isn't a sin. It's not something you cause yourself. And so we're changing the face of this country one day at a time. If we can all work together as a unit, we can solve the problem of suicide, and we can get to zero suicides. We can do this.
In fact, that's a goal of the United Nations, to reduce the suicide rate by 20% by 2025.
That's right, as well as several mental health organizations and suicide prevention groups. That's right. We're at a precipice of change in this country, hell, the world, where people are recognizing brain health matters for what they are. True, real. Real as the hands in front of my face as I hold them here in front of me now. And if we can all recognize that and stop calling people names for hurting upstairs, we can change the world. Together. Only together we can.
I'm going to end on this. If you had one message for someone this moment, listening right now, who is contemplating taking his or her life, what would you tell them?
If you're in that space where you believe you should die by suicide because you're in that much pain, I'm asking you this. Wait. Call the National Suicide Prevention Hotline, 1-800-273-8255. You don't like calling, do the text, 741-741. All you have to do to shift this thought is say three words to someone close to you, to people in crisis services who've got your back. I need help. Ask for help. Ask for help to be safe this day and the next. And even though you might find this pain today, you can find the ability to be here tomorrow. I did. I survived. I'm here. I'll never die by suicide because I know the wake of destruction that that act causes the people in my path. And by God, I deserve to be here. I'm a good person. And so are you. You're no burden to anyone. We need you. You matter to this world. You matter to me.
And on that note, we are out of time. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
That was Kevin Hines, an award-winning global speaker, best-selling author, and documentary filmmaker. His book is Cracked, Not Broken, Surviving and Thriving After a Suicide Attempt. To hear more of this interview, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.